Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The House Romantic, Curating Memorable Interiors for a Meaningful Life by Haskell Harris. Foreword by Anna Spiro. Narrated by Haskell Harris. Publisher's note, in this audio edition, you will hear references to images present in the print and ebook formats of the book. To my parents, the original House Romantics, and to Wiley, my constant companion in creativity. Foreword by Anna Spiro. I met Haskell back in my days of blogging. As many people did back then, we found each other through a common love for homes, interiors, gardens, and style. She has such a kind and warm heart, which I was instantly drawn to. And when I read her story about her own journey of loving and leaving a home, I couldn't believe that we had shared such a similar path. As I read the wonderful stories throughout this book that Haskell has compiled, I can't help but feel a true connection with the sentiment and feelings that have been shared. This book is a celebration of individual style and people who understand the life-changing experience of creating a home that has comfort, meaning, flair, authenticity, nature, and soul. The very first house I remember living in was an old timber house with a beautiful overflowing garden. I was 6 at the time. I have wonderful memories of running wild and free in that beautiful place, picking flowers and setting up roadside flower stalls. The next house we lived in was a modern house with a pool and a treehouse. I will never forget the Eve Klein blue carpet Mom had in the sitting room that she paired with crisp white sofas and plain lemon silk cushions. I spent a lot of time as a young girl rearranging my bedroom and drawing on my bedroom walls, much to Mom's disapproval. My creativity sprouted within the gardens and beautiful rooms Mom decorated with her fabulous style. She taught me how to be an aesthete. This unintentional education and way of living that my parents exposed me to has shaped me, and now I am doing the very same thing with my sons. I have exposed them to a life that is full of creativity, and the homes we have lived in have shaped them and are part of their life journeys. When I was in my late teens, I started working as a junior interior decorator for a well-established designer. I was living at home and redecorating my bedroom like I always did. I still own the very first piece of furniture I bought with my own money when I was 17. I remember trying to work out how I would pay for it. I ended up putting the lovely antique chest of drawers on layaway, and I committed to a 12-week payment plan with the seller. I have kept that piece of furniture with me since that time. And when I look at it, it reminds me of the journey I've had, the ups, the downs, and all the roundabouts. It's been there with me like a loyal friend and confidant, and now my boys love it too, as they know how special it is to me. I'm sure when I'm long gone, it, along with a lot of my furniture and art, will be kept and cherished by them as a small piece of me that holds memories for them throughout their lives. From an early age, I started a tradition that I still keep today. When we would leave a house to move into a new house, I would say a goodbye speech to the house we were leaving, thanking it for having us and wishing it well with its new family. These quiet speeches would always end in me breaking down in tears. It's a really hard thing leaving a house, especially one you truly love, that has been a place of comfort, safety, joy, sadness, and happiness. About 4 years ago, I left a house that I thought was going to be our forever house. It was a magnificent old property. However, our lives changed, and due to my husband and I deciding to go our separate ways, we made the difficult decision to sell our beautiful old family home. This was the home my children cherished even more than I did. It was a very hard time. With a few passing years since leaving our old family home and a lot of reflection, I have come to realize that although the homes we live in are so very, very precious, it's the people, the furniture, the art, and collections that you fill a home with that really matter. These pieces move with us on our journey and hold the key to unlocking the stories of our past. When we move in and out of homes and places, whether it's by choice or circumstance, it's the pieces you take with you that can make a new house feel just like home, as their familiarity is what makes us feel comforted and safe. As our lives pass us by, we can sit in a room of a new house and be surrounded by all of our old friends and feel true comfort, knowing that they have and always will be there to make us feel perfectly at home. Introduction. My colleagues, friends, and family might say I am more than passionate about houses. They are likely to use stronger words: a dreamer, a romantic, a person who idealizes the concept of home and looks for the good in every structure. Both descriptions are accurate, but the latter, this word romantic, gets at the emotional attachment I've felt for my personal spaces, as well as the dozens of others I've lived in vicariously during my 20-year tenure as a shelter editor, most of it spent helming the style ship at Garden & Gun magazine in Charleston, South Carolina. When I first arrived at the title, think Vanity Fair meets British House and Garden meets Field & Stream. The magazine was in its infancy, and it was long before we earned the Oscar of the magazine world, the coveted Ellie for general excellence from the American Society of Magazine Editors. When I reported for duty in July 2008, one of my first tasks was honing ideas for the style section columns. Naturally, before we talked fashion and gardens and art and artisans, my first column idea was about houses. I told my then editor-in-chief, Sid Evans, that if we were going to do home stories, we needed to follow the literary bent of the rest of the magazine and make the writing about them equal to the imagery. In short, we would get it the soul. When he asked me what we should call it, I handed him a tattered copy of A Family Place by the Alabama writer Charles Gaines. There was something about the sentiment of the words family and place that spoke to what I meant, I told Sid. But I also knew we needed brevity, and we needed the word home in it. Then it came to me. Home place. One word that spoke to all of it. In the years since the first iteration of our home place column ran, I've tried my damnedest to seek out projects that live up to the name. Family houses that spoke to specific places. I pursued the same ideas out at home. By the time I was sitting in Sid's office, I'd already owned, renovated, and sold a house in Alabama that I polished to a shine on nights and weekends to make it my own. I hit the ground running in Charleston, too. Landing first in a historic single house, haunted, then a charming carriage house in the Ragbury neighborhood, and most significantly, a craftsman cottage on Grove Street off Hampton Park downtown. This intense love for the structures we call home is a gene I inherited from my parents. They taught me to think of homes more as new friends than as jumbles of wood and metal, and to design interiors and gardens in a deeply personal way, slowly and deliberately. During the pandemic, when our family, like thousands of others, was suddenly at home a great deal, I poured myself into more painting, more planting, and more projects. Doing these things offered a salve for uncertainty, a way to insert order and beauty into life when current affairs delved into chaos. It also allowed hours of early morning quality time with my young son, who often held a paintbrush or a water hose in his tiny hand right beside me as I worked. I don't think I'm alone with this anecdote. Across the world, families turned inward and began to think of home differently, and that hasn't waned. It's only getting stronger. That's exactly why I set out to write this book. I want to offer a new sort of home education, one that's about surrounding yourself not with more products, but with items that hold significance. Each chapter starts with a tour of specific areas of the Grove Street House in Charleston, shown in the print and ebook versions of this book, that illustrate the ideals of being a house romantic, of viewing a structure as more than simply a place to fall asleep each evening. I explain how these principles can be applied to other spaces, exploring how to add meaning, comfort, authenticity, flair, and references to nature, as well as the importance of caring for the soul of houses you've lived in. I also visit some of my design heroes from around the world, whom I call kindred spirits, as their spaces embody these notions in distinct ways. I end the chapters on what I like to call the story behind the stuff. These are profiles on artists or artisans whose creations I love and who also work and live in inspiring spaces, revealing how understanding the human beings behind beautiful objects adds extraordinary value to our design choices. I close the book with a dose of reality. losing the Grove Street house and moving on to another. There are many books that show only the veneer of perfection when it comes to design, that revel only in well-worn style platitudes. To me, the most important part of understanding house romanticism is knowing that it's all a bit ephemeral, that life gets messy, but continuing to look for the good in our house experiences is critical. The uglier the world seems on the outside, the more I hope listeners can learn to create refuge inside, wherever that may be, for however long they call it home. Chapter 1. Meaning. At home with Haskell. Walls can, in fact, talk. They tell the stories of our lives. My maternal grandfather was an introspective creature. A newspaper publisher by day, he very much preferred to remain behind the photos and the headlines. This extended into his private life. I can't remember a time when he was without his Nikon. Even when he went to bed, the camera slept on his nightstand. Photography was his way of documenting the lives of his 7 children without missing a moment, and his armor in social settings where he acted more as party photographer than guest. I can still hear him saying, "Tell me if you're ready," with a big grin after he'd already clicked the shutter, often catching his children, grandchildren, and friends in mid-bite or laugh. When he passed away, one of the hardest things to divvy up into the diaspora of a giant family were the hundreds of leather-bound photo albums that filled acres of bookshelves. I have never forgotten the emotional importance of tethering a family story to the actual wood and nails and walls of a structure. Beyond photos, my dad, also a newspaper publisher, influenced my love of collecting books and keeping only the volumes that told the world what I cared most about. To him, and now in turn to me, books are priceless possessions. He also imparted a curiosity about houses from a young age, particularly via his recollections of architectural details of his grandmother's South Carolina farm and the surrounding gardens and land. He continued this habit of telling mesmerizing house stories about all the other homes he had loved in his life throughout my childhood. He simply noticed things about physical buildings and their landscapes that other people did not. From all of this, I inherited the understanding that houses were very much alive, places that had a spirit in their heyday, and that had the potential to live on in retellings long after the inhabitants and even the structures were gone. I never visited many of the spots he spoke about, but I felt like I did. As a designer, my mom taught me to see the successful interiors of a house not just in the sophistication of a certain stitch or the perfect chintz, but through a different type of messaging than my dad's. She possessed the imagination to memorialize and elevate inanimate objects. Examples include the piece of Tennessee pottery passed down for generations that she had wired into a show-stopping lamp, and the poem my nanny wrote about caring for me as a little girl that Mom framed and gave me as a birthday gift in lieu of toys. With both of my parents, I also witnessed a great deal of sweat equity and hours of thought when it came to creating the magical laboratories for their ideas that my older brother, younger sister, and myself were lucky enough to live in and be a part of. In short, both my mom and my dad daydreamed about houses and gardens all the time. When they were not working, they were painting or plotting or digging out space for some new improvement. This personal devotion to reimagining, layering, and most of all, building their lives around homes is something I absorbed through osmosis, and an experience that gave my childhood homes an unusual amount of depth and purpose. All these lessons followed me into the houses I've lived in as an adult. I bought my first home as a single 25-year-old, and while it was the size of a garden shed, the project gave me a sense of empowerment and creative freedom. I was as hooked as my parents were when they took on their first crumbling 19-room Georgian house as newlyweds. Then it was on to Charleston, where I eventually got married and landed in the cottage on Grove Street. For better or for worse, I seemed to be drawn to spots that need love and care. I never chose the biggest or the newest or the fanciest property in the right neighborhood. And that was deliberate. Before my paintbrush ever touched a wall, I saw that these diminutive spaces had something interesting to say if the right caretaker came along. And I tried to be that person for the limited amount of time I spent living in them. One of the best tricks to conjuring meaning inside these abodes happens in the editing and the display. It isn't about the volume of things, but the essence of very specific art and books and heirlooms. And it doesn't have to involve some sort of brutal culling, but simply taking an inventory of items that bring positive emotions to the surface, such as grounding feelings like contentment or confidence or connection. In the Grove Street house, I spent hours narrowing down photos from generations of my family and my husband's family to frame and hang in the library, an ideal spot for a bit of reflection. I felt like concentrating everything in this one space, rather than scattering frames in every room, not only helped with clutter, but added more interest too. I decided on pairings like our childhood photos hung side by side, portraits of our grandmothers who were formative in our lives, our wedding photo, images from our parents and their childhoods, and more modern portraits. I also framed important letters, invitations, and other family pieces that might otherwise be relegated to the attic. In the process, the space morphed into a giant scrapbook to pore over anytime we or our friends felt like it. It also became the main hub for our book collection. Similarly, the family and dining rooms of Grove Street operated as a gallery for pieces of family art collected intentionally over time to canvas every inch of space in both rooms. Art is always in the eye of the beholder, and can include not only pedigree pieces, but the humble and the personal too, from a framed abstract in crayon by our toddler, to mounted textiles gathered during travel, to architectural remnants, and more. On Grove Street and in every other home I've lived in, the objects, the furniture, the lighting, and even the accessories also symbolize far more than their utilitarian purpose. As a style editor, I've seen so many homes that are thrillingly beautiful, but the ones that stick with me most, and with readers, are the ones that feel personal. That's because you don't have to look at what someone else is doing to dream up a remarkable space. The real path to originality is shining a spotlight on your life. In this chapter, we'll visit the interior designer Angie Hernowski, the Texas shop owner and international vagabond Courtney Barton, and the antiquarian Azuri Aki of Madame de la Maison, who all bring their own versions of meaning into their homes in one-of-a-kind ways. Bringing it all together. To keep all the disparate styles of photography in the library cohesive, I printed the images in black and white and chose frames in chalk black, silver, and gold to impart a collected feeling. The deep blue paint on the trim, walls, baseboards, and millwork helped keep the focus on the memorabilia and the books. I had it custom mixed. After about four tries, I got it. Natural beauty. I've been a fan of Les Indiennes since Mary Mulcahy founded the textile line in 2002, when she created her first motifs around the idea that doing things by hand matters. She found craftsmen in India doing a type of printing called Kalam Kari, while integrating natural dyes on organic cotton, a process that's easy on the environment. The artisans steam set the hue into the fabrics, which creates the soft, broken-in feeling that Mulcahy's offerings are known for. A life eclectic. In the dining room, the mix of art that belonged to us as a couple, combined with the farm table I spent many Thanksgivings around as a child for our annual feast, gave the whole space an especially meaningful vibe. There is a mix of work by photographers and illustrators we worked with at Garden & Gun, pedigree pieces by artists who were close friends, and humble sketches and scribbles by our toddler, among other minutiae that held significance for us and no one else. It was a museum of our lives and our work. A note on marginalia. Noun. Marks made in the margins of a book or other document. They may be scribbles, comments, glosses, critiques, doodles, drolleries, or illuminations. Wikipedia. I am a huge fan of putting things that matter out in the open, so tucking a poem or a photo or a postcard into the frame of our dining room mirror became something of a sport over time. This gesture and other similar ones have felt like the notes in the margins of life. The tiny artist. When he was a baby, one of my little boy's favorite things to scribble on was a cardboard box. One afternoon, while we were waiting for a hurricane to pass outside the front door, he scribbled a masterpiece, and I sat on the floor and doodled too. Later, as I was about to recycle it all, I cut this piece of the box out and had it framed. There are so many wonderful mail order framing resources now that make this idea a cinch. Kindred Spirit, Angie Hernowski, Charleston, South Carolina. I met Angie Hernowski years ago when I first moved to Charleston and loved her from the start, both as an interior designer and as a person. I was in awe of her talent and admired her caring and cosmopolitan nature, and she laughed at my jokes. As our friendship deepened, I also developed a respect for the ways in which she showed up for every important person in her life, including me. These qualities appear in her work, too, if you pay attention. In her new, very dreamy personal house, which she built from scratch out of Carolina cypress, the tableau of every room presents an aesthetic feast that brings the people and places of her life into living color. I notice different things each time I spend time there, but I've always been drawn to her jewelry and ceramics. Unlike some designers who might tuck these items out of view, Angie uses them to enrich the rooms where she displays them. I'm intrigued by her jewelry collection because Angie has an understated French way of wearing things. Her pieces are not trendy. They are her talismans and her trademarks. My favorite is her gold Omega watch, which belonged to her paternal grandfather. She had it refitted to her tiny wrist. I am an only child, and my dad was an only child, and he passed away when I was 6. So I was also the only grandchild. And when my grandparents passed away, I inherited all their jewelry, she says. I'm not one to wear a lot of different things, and I've always worn pieces that are personal to me. She keeps everything in beautiful containers in her bedroom. The vessels hold prized pieces, like the monogrammed gold heart locket that belonged to Angie's grandmother that Angie wore on her wedding day, a sterling silver cuff from the south of France that was a gift from Angie's mom, and even a new edition of stacking rings Angie commissioned to be handmade by a designer in Maine. I just like to style things so I get to see all of the meaningful pieces, she says. It's personal, but it's also a form of design. This wild, colorful environment where she chooses what she will wear each day is akin to getting dressed in an otherworldly paradise. I knew when I built the house that I wanted my bedroom to be an enveloping extension of the bamboo and banana trees outside my windows, she says. After looking for the right print for months, and even considering a mural, Angie fell in love with a kaleidoscopic collaboration between Vootsa and C.W. Stockwell, so much so that she not only used the wallpaper, but also continued the same print for the drapery panels. I wanted the pattern to wrap the room to make it seamless, she says. Other vignettes in the house bring her pottery and books into focus. In one area, Angie clustered several vases and bowls together that illustrate the breadth of time periods evident in her ceramics. I started collecting in my 20s at flea markets, she says. I've refined my eyes since then, and now I try only to invest in pieces that I really love. Books are another weakness for Angie, thanks to her former career as a graphic designer. Books bring so much life and art to a space, she says. Just seeing them stacked around the house can inspire your children to be curious and to wonder at what might be inside. Sometimes Angie will also buy books for their thoughtful aesthetics. I love book covers and book jackets. It's all art, the book design, the cover art, the typography, the writing, all of it. I vividly recall Angie shipping herself a huge box of beautiful books, all in Spanish, from her latest Mexico adventure. It all works, and it doesn't slip into the sweet or the saccharine thanks to additions that bring a sense of erudition. Case in point, the thorn mirror she purchased from the American expat, artist, and antiques dealer Mike Diaz after visiting his studio in Mexico City. I remember ending up at this beautiful old house that was full of Mexican and European antiques mixed with modern furniture, as well as his pieces, and being really moved, she says. Angie bought one of his mirrors and saved it for the perfect moment to hang it when her new house was complete. She is very patient, and good things come to those who savor each new addition. But her true gift is being able to curate spaces for her clients that feel just as narrated. I love a home that piques my interest and makes me ask, what's their story? Where have they traveled? What are their passions in life? She says, adding, I think the same can be true for homes that are professionally designed. It's all in how you personalize it to feel distinctive to its inhabitants. Rainbow Connection. Angie's spaces are such a refined combination of her Kentucky roots and her personal relationships with cities like Charleston, Miami, and Los Angeles, and countries like Mexico and Morocco. This print, visible in the print and ebook versions of this book, is a contemporary take by Vautza on the iconic banana leaf print first designed by C.W. Stockwell in 1924. This new collaboration had more of a Miami vibe, and I knew it was the winner immediately, Angie says. Kindred Spirit, Courtney Barton, Houston, Texas. One of the most tried and true ways to add substance to a house is via the magic of objects collected on adventures around the world. It's an art form that the textile designer and shop owner Courtney Barton has spent her adult life perfecting. She says it all started with a fateful move to Malaysia with her husband in 2009 after a stint in the fashion world working for Ralph Rucci and Jill Stewart. It was during this expat season that I began collaborating with artisans I met during my travels to design home goods. I amassed a collection of antique linens and other exotic finds, so my business grew organically, she says. Over the years, Courtney set up shop first in Houston and most recently in the worldwide mecca for antiques and interesting finds, Round Top, Texas. Both locales are slightly different in their offerings, but they have a common thread in the textiles Courtney designs alongside artisans in Rajasthan, India, and sells in her stores. These soft, subtle creations are the reason I know Courtney. Years ago, she sent a sample of a dohar she designed so that I could see and feel it in person. At the time, I was unaware of the long history of this uniquely Indian blanket. Her take on the idea involved layers of combed cotton, all block printed by hand with motifs she drew and had dyed with the gentle colors she's known for. To me, the dohar fell somewhere between a gauze coverlet and a quilt and felt as suited to a humid southern summer as it did a sweltering Indian one. There was something familiar about it, as if it bridged two cultures. And it is perhaps the staggering combination of both vintage and modern textiles inside Courtney's home that most clearly tells of her vagabond wanderings. Handmade products bear the marks of the artist, leaving no two alike, she says. This devotion to soft goods is no doubt influenced by her French Acadian grandmother, who instilled an early love of items made by hand. She embroidered and monogrammed every tea towel and bed linen, Courtney remembers, and I use many of these same textiles in my house today, and I'm so inspired by their lasting impact. Beyond just textiles, the way in which Courtney combines her heirloom pieces with more modern additions of her own is also delightful. It's a wonderful contrast to see an antique lamp base Courtney found on a trip to China, topped off with a shade made from one of her printed cotton fabrics, for example. There simply isn't a room in her home where these seemingly opposing ideas don't live in beautiful harmony. Courtney's uncle, an antiques dealer, used to ask her, "Do you love it? Do you find value in it?" when she called for advice on buying trips. "I still abide by this code, and it's never led me astray," she says. Even the colors chosen from her home stem from experiences abroad. The peachy pink of her living room is pulled directly from an ancient oil painting she discovered at a market in India that hangs near the fireplace. The chalky brown gray in her dining room is the precise color of the artful wooden blocks used to put ink to cotton for her fabrics. "I still find myself in constant amazement of the unforgettable sights I've seen and the people I've met," she says. "I've witnessed every extreme imaginable, both high and low, and I'm better for it." Courtney will be jet-setting into more collaborations soon. The first will be a range of bespoke quilts created in tandem with her artisan team in India. "I want the pieces to speak to the heart and reflect the same enthusiasm in a space." Travel as autobiography. One takeaway from Courtney's aesthetic is the importance of close observation while traveling and bringing back bits of this and that to recall the human beings behind the artistry from all over the world. Even if you just head out for the weekend somewhere close by, seek out artisans to support and bring their work home. Their story then becomes part of yours. The Story Behind the Stuff, Vintage Tableware by Azuri Aki of Madame de la Maison, Paris, France. Many years ago, I took a brief hiatus from magazines and worked in the event design business in Charleston. One thing I observed in that world, at least in the United States, is that most stemware and tabletop sourced for high-end events is rented and new. It makes sense from a practical standpoint, but I felt that these one-of-a-kind parties lack the extra...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?